In a keynote interview with author Kevin Smolkler at last weekend's PubWest 2017 conference, critic Ron Charles offers an insider's tour of one of the last remaining newspaper book sections in the U.S. He also revealed what influence Jeff Bezos has on the books that are reviewed. As editor of the Washington Post Book World, Ron Charles is responsible for an entire ecosystem of book reviewing, which now spans print, audio, and social media, including the satirical video series Totally Hip Book Reviews. Ron Charles has won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Best Criticism, as well as a First Place Award for Arts and Entertainment Commentary from the Society for Features Journalism. In 2014, he served as a judge for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. I want to welcome Ron Charles and Kevin Smolkler in this special recording from PubWest 2017. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book.
When I was asked to do this, the first thing I said was, I need to guarantee this is not going to be a 5-minute session, meaning this is not going to lead up to the question on everybody's mind, how do I get my books reviewed in the Washington Post Book World? Because that is a 90-second conversation. So let's get that out of the way right now and address that issue before we get onto the meat of it.
That is the question I usually get asked. And the answer is simple. It's stacks of unmarked bills. It's really hard. We're getting about 150 books a day. I cannot read 150 books a day. I can barely read half that. And what you imagine and what I would like to do is to read all the books and then at the end of the day pick the good ones and review those. That is not what happens. We're part of a newspaper. We cover largely the books that are going to make news or that we anticipate will make news or that have already made news. So that drives the vast majority of our coverage. And we've got about 20 slots a week. So if you subtract from that all the big authors that we all think of as, you know, the ones we must review, there are just not that many slots left for new voices, for the discovered book, for the little book, for the small publisher. But there are some spaces left, and you can get into those spaces, and we love to discover those, you know, as often as we can. But I just want, you know the challenge, and I want to confirm that it is a great challenge to get into those spots. But we need to have your books early. They need to be pitched to us in a way that we can clearly and quickly see what the news value is. The fact that it's a great book is not news. All the books I get are great books. Every book comes with a parent's recommendation about how wonderful it is, so that does not make it stand out. What will help me is some sort of context in the news or in history or an anniversary or some very compelling author story. Sometimes a good description of the book will help me group it with other books. Your book was a beneficiary of that sort of grouping recently, because you never know, you know, I'm seeing patterns in publishing and I want to collect 3 or 4 books together. Frankly, it's easier for small publishers to get in on our genre lists, which we publish every week. We do science fiction and romance and poetry. And those critics who pick their own books frequently pick books that I've not heard of, sometimes from publishers that are very young and new. So that's a good way to break in too. So it can happen, but a lot of it has to do with how effectively those books are pitched to us. Is that good enough?
My book is about 80s teen movies, and when it was reviewed in the Washington Post, I was over the moon and told my publisher, and she just said, thank God for Stranger Things. Because that... because without a show set in the 1980s about teenagers currently, you know, buzzing about the culture, like... Is there any news? There's zero news value to my book. I think that question is entirely understandable for a publisher to ask or wonder about. But it seems at the same time to sort of overestimate the power of what you do, and underestimate the power of the book reviewing ecosystem that we are living in right now in 2017. So could you give us a little historical context about the world of book reviewing you entered into 20 years ago and versus the one now?
Yeah, 20 years ago I started at the Christian Science Monitor as their book section editor, and every paper in the country had, you know, a book section. They were of varying quality, but everybody did it. And over the last 20 years, probably 10 years ago, almost all those book sections died. I mean, you know this, around the country. The book sections just evaporated. Everybody lost their job. It was really, really bloody for a long time. It seemed like the end of the world. But at the same time, of course, all kinds of other places blossomed, with the internet, with little journals, blogs, online reviewers. There are many, many more people writing reviews now, I'm sure, than ever before. So, we know that we're competing with a vastly large and more complex ecosystem of book reviews than we ever were before. We know that most people get their book recommendations from friends and then NPR. Book review recommendations, you know, come down that list, from those, much more influential, sources. So when we don't review a book, I don't think to myself, you know, this book is going to die. This book, well, no one will ever hear of this book, because I know there are so many other sources for good book criticism. And aren't you impressed? I mean, when you go on Goodreads or Amazon, the kind of time these people put into reviewing books, I think it's amazing. I mean, there are some horrible things, and people say stupid stuff about, you know, they don't like this book because it costs too much or something, or it arrived late. But mixed in with that, there are people that will sit down, people you've never heard of, and they'll write 800 or 900 words. And I think it's really compelling. They're really talented people, amateur people, who just love books and are writing great reviews and sending them out into the world. I think that's wonderful. So the ecosystem, which seemed to be dying off, in fact, became more complex and more beautiful in a way.
Yeah.
Does that sound really Pollyannish?
No. It feels to me like we in a very short time went from sort of a blanched tundra to a rainforest. Like,
it got really bad, you know. I left the monitor because I thought the monitor was about to close. I was about 4 or 5 years early, but they did eventually close the newspaper and went to an online site and a magazine. And I didn't think the book section would survive. So I started madly applying all around the country to book sections. Most of them wrote, well, most of them didn't write back, but, most of them that did write back said, we're closing our book section. I wrote to the Dallas Morning News the day they left their critic go. You know, particularly, oh, then you have an opening. No. No. It wasn't like that. You know, I began to sort of have survivor's guilt after a while. There were so many people, being laid off. It seemed bad. But, I was at AWP yesterday. And I could not believe the room was, this huge conference room was full of what seemed to me hundreds of little journals, all of them really sharply designed. Many of them seemed to me to be doing great work. I mean, they're all acts of, you know, despair against hope. But the fact that they were there, that they were doing this good work, that they were looking for new writers, I mean, that is where the ecosystem begins, right? Those little journals discover people and they work their way up to bigger and bigger journals and then magazines and then newspapers. It seems to me very healthy.
Yeah, I mean, not every one of them is you know, funded by George Plimpton's father. It just doesn't They all start somewhere, and most don't start with that kind of natural advantage some of the bigger known journals have. Within this current ecosystem, what do you see as sort of the mandate? You sitting in the captain's chair of one of these last remaining daily newspaper book sections, what do you see as your mandate, which is a way of asking, how do you make editorial decisions about what you write about?
We want to celebrate good books that we think our readers want to read. I'm trying to identify books that they will enjoy. So a lot of our reviews are, frankly, recommendations. That's not to say we don't run negative reviews, because we also want to save our readers time. We know they're going to see big stacks of books by popular people in the bookstore, and if we can save them the 10 or 12 hours it takes to read a book by letting them know that this book is a stinker, then we'll tell them. But we don't go after debut authors, typically. We don't pan books you would not otherwise hear of. It makes for a really boring review. Here is a book you have not heard of. Don't read it. Books aren't like other kinds of entertainment, right? Nobody accidentally reads a book. It takes tremendous effort. I mean, unlike we were talking about this at breakfast, you know, a TV show or a movie or even a play, besides from the cost of the book, it's 10 or 15 hours of your time. There's no other form of entertainment like that. And every reader to a person tells me what they want to know is, what should I read next? So we're trying to identify those things for our readers. The editorial decisions are really painful. I don't think any of us in the book section ever get over the sense that we're failing because we cannot review all the books we want to in the paper. We pass over so many good books because we just don't have the room. It is really, really painful. And we don't get to even all the very big name authors that we'd like to because there just are so many slots in the week. We do the best we can. We miss things all the time. We just get used to, you know, knowing that we'll try and do better the next week. But it is a real struggle to make those decisions. What we're trying to do is create a diversity of coverage. We know our readership is more vast than ever before around the country and the world now. We want to make sure we're covering lots of different kinds of books. We want to make sure that the book section does not just reflect our own particular interests, although we know that it will to some extent. So we do keep track of how we're covering different subjects and genres, books from different parts of the world. We want to make sure that we're not concentrating too much on particular subjects. I think I'm repeating myself now like a book section. Some of that I had to build into the schedule. For instance, every Monday we cover thrillers and mysteries. I knew we wanted to cover more poetry, but at the end of every year we look back and we just hadn't been covering it. So I hired a woman to pick her three favorite collections of poetry and review them every month. So, you know, it's only 36 books, but it's a lot more books than we used to do of poetry. So now at the end of the year, I know we've reviewed 36 collections that a well-qualified poetry editor thought were pretty good. I did the same thing with romance, because every year I would say to myself, I know romance is a huge section of the market. We're not satisfying that part of the market. Next year I'll do better. I'll look for some of the big romance novels, and the year would pass, and I hadn't done it. So I hired Sarah McLean, a best-selling romance author herself, and every month she picks three of her favorite romance novels. So at the end of the year, we've reviewed 36 great romance novels. So I found that when we built those things into the schedule, we were much better about ensuring that we were covering a diverse range of books. Same with sci-fi, too. And when I just hired Catherine Powers up in Boston to review audiobooks for us every month. So that'll start next week, because we know that's a huge and growing part of the market, too. It's amazing. The books, the young man, our office manager, wheels this cart up sometimes twice a day, filled with books. He's gone through it and taken out, you know, the textbooks and reprints and things like that that we wouldn't do. But it's still way too many books. And the nonfiction editor and I go through it so quickly and so superficially, it would make you weep. But you know, it's Fantasia. It's Lucy in the Chocolate Factory. It's just unbelievable how many books are coming in. And we just do the best we can.
We were talking about this. There is a natural disadvantage to reviewing books just simply based on where the audience is coming from, which is that it's going to take longer for the reader has a higher commitment to the thing you're reviewing than if you were reviewing music or film or television. And you have the backlog problem. People simply do not have stacks of DVDs on their nightstands or the way they do books. Everybody wants to know what to read next, and everybody thinks they have no time for whatever you're going to suggest to read next. To say nothing of the fact that even 20 years ago when you started, there was simply a lot less for people to look at and spend their time with. One of your answers to that conundrum has been these videos that we saw at the very beginning. And I'm going to play another one right now, and we'll talk about that in just a second.
Hello, I'm Ron Charles. You may know me as one of the most romantic figures in the book world. But believe me, I wasn't always the magnetic alpha male you know today. No, I was once like you, lost, awkward, dreading each Valentine's Day because I had no idea how to woo my coy mistress.
Sweets to a sweet.
Get that poison away from me.
Dawn is that sweet flower of love.
Don't you know how environmentally destructive the flower industry is?
Oh, mirror, mirror, what am I doing wrong?
Aw, Ron.
Diana Gabaldone?
You know your Valentine doesn't want a hasty, impersonal gift. What your Valentine would like is the perfect gift, a carefully chosen book.
She's right, you know. You have to choose a Valentine's gift from the heart.
But
I'm a professional book critic. I don't have a heart.
Oh, you can do this. Let's practice. Which is more romantic, this dirt devil handheld vacuum or this new biography of Rumi by Brad Gooch?
Well, that biography would be no help at all when it comes to cleaning stairs.
This is so much worse than I thought.
For Valentine's Day, wouldn't she like to learn about the great Sufi love poet?
Okay. I can do this. Just give me another chance.
Okay. What's more romantic, this new garbage disposal or the annotated Pride and Prejudice?
It is a truth universally acknowledged that Jane Austen is more romantic than the kitchen appliance.
Yes, that's it!
I'm ready, Cupid. I can do this.
I know you can. If your Valentine has a poetic soul, consider the love poems of Pablo Neruda or Nikki Giovanni.
A nice used edition of Wuthering Heights or The French Lieutenant's Woman shows you have good taste and passion.
A signed first edition of The Princess Bride could set you back $4,000. But this is true love. Do you think this happens every day? Or maybe you should like a copy of The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks, in which case you should find somebody your own age. If you're like me, when you think sexy, you think National Geographic. The world's most romantic destinations might just be the book that relaunches your love life. Dawn! I've got something for you.
In a minute.
You should be kissed, and often, and by somebody who knows how.
Yeah, I could not agree more.
Just keep that image of Ron in the straw cowboy hat up there. Give me just a quick breakdown on like is there a whole room dedicated to strange costumes, you know, and angel wings and halos and tucked in with the video equipment? Just give me a 30 seconds on how the production of these things happens.
It has gotten way out of control now. The kids are out of the house, so we've got these two spare bedrooms that are just packed with costumes and the lights and all this equipment and this enormous green screen in the dining room. Yeah, it's just been chaos.
And who does the directing and the filming and then?
My wife does the photography and I write the scripts and, you know, the two of us act them out.
All right. So tell me about the feedback. What kind of feedback have you gotten? Who's the audience for these things? What are the responses of publishers? Because we have a lot in this room.
The audience is almost exclusively publishers. You know, it started about 6 years ago. I was getting really depressed about the incredibly stupid things journalists were being asked to do to reach a younger audience. That was basically it. You know, so we had to be on all these new platforms. We had to constantly be debasing ourselves, you know, sending out Snapchats of our stories and things like that. And it was just really hard to get used to. And so I thought, well, what would be the most ridiculous extension of that? That would be 60-second video book reviews, you know, because the young people are all online watching YouTube. So I just took my latest review, I think it was Mona Simpson's My Hollywood, and with my wife holding the camera, I just ran around the house and we just acted out the review that I'd written, and then I put it on Facebook or something for my friends, you know, and we laughed about, you know, what was happening to journalism nowadays. But it totally took off. And so I started to make more. The management of the Post at that time was very ambivalent about these things. They basically henpecked me into stopping. It kept sending me notes. My favorite note was, no hats. No idea why. So I stopped. I just gave it up. Because writing satire is really nerve-wracking for me anyhow, because I'm so afraid of pissing somebody off. But then the new management came in, and they were pushing me really hard to start again. I didn't take them seriously till last year, when my evaluation came back, and both managing editors of the Post, you know, who have other more important things, you know, like saving a democracy, for instance. but they both took time out of their day to tell me, you must begin the videos again. And not only that, but they gave me this very expensive camera and microphone and sent three videographers to the house to train my wife one day how to set the lights and how to do the filming and everything. So we knew, you know, they were totally serious about this now. So we try and do one about every 3 weeks. The response is great fun and hilarious for all. My daughter's in a couple of them, too. It's just been a blast. It is the most
fun thing we do. We always did these as a family for holidays, for one another, you know, when the kids were little. So for us, it just seems perfectly natural. The publishers have been great. Like that last scene, all those books and the posters came from Avon Romance. You know, I just called up a friend of mine and I said, you know, I've got this scene. It needs to be my wife surrounded in romance books and like posters of hunky guys. The next day, this enormous, like refrigerator-sized box arrives on the door. You know, they were happy to do it. So it's been great fun. The Post pushes them pretty hard when they can, you know, off on the entertainment side of the website. And the audience seems, if not large, then enthusiastic enough to keep doing it. So I love it. I don't know if it, you know, I can't imagine what John Yardley thinks or Michael Derda, real book critics. But maybe we are reaching a younger, hipper audience. I don't know.
You know, we talked about this a little bit. Like the idea that journalism in macro and book reviewing in micro is some sort of dignified button-upped affair is a very small segment of the history of journalism in this, a very small time period in the history of this country. And if you think about people like H.L. Mencken and you know, A.J. Leibling and people we admire from the hallowed yore of journalism, those guys were bare-knuckled and skin-kneed and just plain crude and mean sometimes. Like, there was something really rough and tumble and scrappy and sometimes joyous and sometimes deliberately undignified about it. Have you gotten any, this is beneath the dignity of the Washington Post, or?
It is. But, the Post now, in its thriving reiteration, is determined to find readers wherever they are. We produce the best highbrow journalism in the world, I think, and we also produce this. We produce the full range. We are without judgment now. Whatever you want to watch, on whatever platform you want to watch it, we're going to be there. I do think we participated. I mean, there are a lot of reasons book sections died, but I think you sort of hit upon it there. The book review sections around the country got too dull. They were too polite and too nice and too boring and to a feat. I think the British model is much more rambunctious and much more funny. And I think, I hope that we start to, obviously online it's happening, but we should have been a little more rough and tumble. I think it would have been better for book culture if we hadn't gotten so cozy. Part of the problem is we all fell for this model where novelists review one another's books and then approve one another's applications to Yadu and one another's grants, and they get their kids into one another's colleges, and it all just gets so comfortable. You hardly ever find a really hilariously negative review anymore, which can, I know it hurts, but it also can be very fun to read now and then. I wish book reviewing culture weren't quite so nice in the dullest sense.
It is impossible to overlook the fact that this influx of resources you're talking about has something to do with the Washington Post's new owner, which is a little known man named Jeff Bezos, who started a little known company named Amazon. So I'm assuming because of that, your mandate as head of the book review section is to have reviews correspond in an affiliate marketing fashion with things that are on Amazon. So books that you review are positioned next to barbecue grills and roofing tiles and things like that that can be sold easily and frictionlessly on Amazon, right?
No. I have never, ever heard from anyone from Amazon. Yeah. I have a mortgage to pay. Mr. Bezos made it clear publicly that he had no intention of interfering with the editorial content of the Washington Post. He has never done that or any of his people. Have never done that with the book section. I'm in the newsroom every day. I've never heard a rumor of a whisper that he's had any influence on the editorial content of the Washington Post. He's been very, very involved in the engineering side, in the development of the website, in the kind of technical problems, programming problems. I don't understand those, but I know they're not editorial issues. There has been, I swear to you, absolutely no influence on the book coverage from Amazon. We do have an affiliate arrangement with Amazon, where if you click on a title in a book review, it does take you to Amazon. That began 2.5 years before Mr. Bezos bought the paper. That was an arrangement that the Grahams made. But those affiliate arrangements, like all advertising in the Washington Post, takes place on the other side of a very strong firewall. No editors are involved. We don't add those links. We don't know what's going on with advertising. That's a very impenetrable wall at the Washington Post. I do have some uncomfortable, sometimes angry conversations with independent booksellers, but I just have nothing to say. I'm not in a position to defend or to be involved in those kind of discussions. It just isn't, I mean, he owns and funds one of the world's great newspapers, and I'm very grateful to him, full stop.
Thanks, Ron.
Thanks,
everybody. Thank you. This is great. This is fun.